It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast back on the air. I don't know if it's air. What is it? Waves? Electronic magnet?
The tubes? What? I think it's on the tubes.
Is it glass? Like, isn't it Google Fibers? What are we on?
Zeros and ones.
Zeros and ones. Well, we are catching the rhetorical boomerangs, throwing them right back into the faces of those throwing them at us. We're doing complicated times require sophisticated techniques, more understanding of how messages work, how to defend yourself, how to build good ones. So come on, get your learn on. It's the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, escaped professor, late night comedy writer, all the things, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. The purpose of this podcast, I talk to comedians about their politics and their careers, and I uncensor them and let them do whatever they want that they don't want to do in clubs anymore because of too much blowback. That's interesting. I sometimes have people from opposite perspectives than mine, and I convert conservatives on the podcast. I take them through a recovery process. And I talk to persuasion pros, message pros, anybody that does something with public words. And that's kind of what we're doing today. I've got another entertainment pro on here. I'm going to put you under comedy pros.
That's sure.
Kind of your thing today. This guy I've known off and on, like we met at the Austin Film Festival years ago. And he's the guy who helped invent talking meat. Like he invented some talking meat. I worked with monsters, cartoons, stretchy characters. He's been at Turner, Cartoon Network, Adult Swim, Disney, Netflix, you name it. He's probably been in the animated bowels of that organization. And one of the original producer directors, creators?
Producers, producer and editor. Like there was no, it's a long story, but yeah, I got a producer credit on Aqua Teen, even though I was not above the line. Let's put it that way.
Ah, okay. Of Aqua Teen Hunger Force. So we'll talk about that a little bit today. J. Wade Edwards.
Thank you for using my full name.
J. Wade is a cool name.
It's not bad. I like it. My grandfather was George Wade. So yeah, I like it. I have to go by it because there's a porn director named J. Edwards and jedwards.com is a bondage porn site and it's not actually me.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it's not. That's good cover, man.
Yeah. The internet is lazy and he will sometimes get my children's television credits.
Which is no, I like saying Jay Wade's fun to say. It's, hey man, it's yeah. Jay Wade.
It's better. So like yeah.
Jay Lowe or something.
Don't Google me at work.
I wonder if like everybody's probably got some, if you really knew all the porn stars, everybody's got some kind of doppelganger in the porn industry.
I mentioned this in a talk with a college class last week that I was helping a friend out on, and it turns out everyone on the panel had the equivalent of some porn star with their name.
Nice, I like it.
So I'm not that original.
All right, so here we go. Let's do this. Run us just a little bit of background. You started in Georgia. Are you a Georgia guy? You were in Atlanta.
Oh well, I grew up in Florida but escaped.
Nice.
And then went to college in Alabama, Auburn, Alabama.
But you didn't escape that far.
I didn't escape that far. It was 8 hours away from my parents, which seemed like the right distance to go to college.
That sounds about right.
And I liked Auburn, football season's still fun.
Auburn, some football chops, right?
It's got to
rely on Auburn to,
I went to a lot of football games at Auburn. Yeah. Big Southern, it was about 20,000 students. It's mostly an engineering and agriculture school, neither of which I really fit into, even though I really liked the school and wanted to go there. So I ended up in public relations or business. That wasn't really me either, but eventually I took a video editing class. This was in the era of videotape, not pre-digital. And I went in to edit a project and edited for like 10 hours in a row and forgot to eat or pee or do anything else. And I just loved it. So I changed my major the next day to communications and have been editing ever since.
Ever since. Hardcore editor.
Yeah, that was 30 years ago.
What are some other names for editors? Like, are you choppers? Are you chop shop? What is
cutters? Yeah. Like you'll use the word cut a lot. Even though it's all digital, you used to use scissors or razor blades when it was film.
Yeah, I remember some of that stuff. My son is an editor. He's 19, and he's about to jump into a job with Psionics out in San Diego. And he's never done anything that hasn't been like three computer screens and zzzz. So.
Sure. I was lucky in that I moved to Atlanta from college in 1991, and that's when the very first digital nonlinear editing computers were being manufactured and used professionally. My first job was at one of two editing facilities in Atlanta that had an Avid.
Nice.
There were two in the whole city, and I happened to get a job at one of them.
Well, that's fortuitous.
It was very fortuitous. So I was doing mostly I was an assistant editor, but I worked up to being like kind of the night manager, where I would digitize the tapes that came in during the day overnight for the next day's edit sessions. So I was in charge of keeping the computer running, essentially, which was not easy now, but it certainly wasn't easy back then. The biggest hard drive you could buy was 600 megabytes.
Oh, wow.
And it was the size of a car battery and weighed just about as much.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look back, like even those jobs, you know, that have recently disappeared, like that one, like the night guy who has to turn the stuff, make it editable for the next day, like digitizing it.
It's interesting because you still use the terminology of film production in digital. You know, if you're shooting digital, you still have to make dailies, which is converting one digital file into 7 or 8 or 10 different flavors of digital files so that the director can review it. Or it goes to an archive at a very high resolution, or it goes to a, you know, medium editable resolution for the editor. So you still use dailies and you still use a lot of that terminology, even though it's, you know, not film anymore.
It's an interesting version of history, right? I mean, the amount of archived stuff that's been made for all these different projects is probably bigger. I mean, just the massive library of that stuff. Most of it never gets used. It gets cut and right. I don't know where it goes to live, but it's a certain way of documenting the world and reality that just has never existed before.
This era of like from the digital era on, I feel like all that history is going to disappear. Like even now, you know, when in the 90s and early 2000s, when you were mastering, when you were creating a master of a TV show, it was a piece of tape. It was a Digibeta tape or a D2 tape. Now, there is no longer VCRs that can play those tapes back.
Right.
Like all that technology is gone. Like the head that read the videotape, like those heads are not being manufactured anymore. And they wear out. So there are thousands of hours of videotape that can never be played back.
Just locked away in a book that nobody can read anymore.
It's there's no Rosetta Stone for digital. Some film companies are still archiving on film. They're like, that's the long-term, like there's resolution lists, like there's no resolution to it because it's a physical piece of media. Some people are still archiving on 35 millimeter film because that's kind of technology proof.
Right. It's so bizarre. Like nobody, when you get in the guts of things like that, the guts of production, and you start to see like technology constantly rolling through. Here comes another big wave of technology to shift everything. Like I had a buddy who was a colorist, I think, whatever it's called, in video for a while. And worked in it for quite a while, made his living at it. And then he sort of became a stand up and left that stuff. And at one point was like, maybe I should go back into that. And he looked at it and he like, I don't know anything.
It's all changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the one piece of advice I often give to people is be ready to learn all new technology every 5 years, at least, you know, that's just part of the job. If you're going to be an editor, you're going to work in post-production, there's new technology. You're going to have to learn every 5 years. So just get used to it.
So do you like that? Are you a technology guy? Do you like absorbing new techs?
I do. I certainly do. I certainly have my preferences of what I like to work in and what I feel like works best for me. Like I like technology, but I'm also kind of a minimalist. I'm also anti-technology. When I started working at Netflix Animation three years ago, it was a new studio to house all the animation projects that they had in development. And so I walked in and I was like employee number 72, and now there's 800. And they asked me what I wanted to work on. I got to pick what kind of computer system I wanted, what kind of tech, you know, I prefer Premiere to Avid. So I got to work in Premiere, you know, what kind of storage I wanted. And as I was kind of designing this from scratch, as I preferred it, as opposed to working for Disney or another, you know, really the only other monolith that I've worked for is Disney, whereas every editor worked on the exact same computer system at Disney, whether it was appropriate for your production or not, which sucked.
That sounds like Disney.
Yeah, but then again, they had 85 editors, and that's a lot to manage if every editor is working on a different system. So, you know, studio management-wise, I understand.
Yeah.
Show production-wise, it's a nightmare. So Netflix was new, and they like, do whatever you want. So I ended up with no mixing board, because oftentimes editors are, you know, they have like a 64 channel mixing board on their desk and they use it as a volume knob.
Right.
So I reduced and reduced and reduced until I had nothing on my desk but a monitor, a keyboard, a mouse, and a knob for volume. Like, oh yeah, there's this. It was just like a heavy round knob. It was metal. And it had a hash mark on it where this is your volume where you work at. You know, if you want to hear something louder, but this is the volume where you always work at. So it was literally like a volume knob and a keyboard, and that's all I had on my desk, and it was glorious.
Nice.
So I'm yes, I like technology, but I like to minimize it and only use the appropriate pieces. Long story.
Well, that's one of the things I'm impressed by. Like, so I've always worked in the creative, you know, I've always been the writer and messing around with those knobs and those dials. And like, I get super fascinated by word choice and tone and you know, all the tiny minutiae within that stuff. But when I see people who are super tech and are working it all the time, the adjustments that they make in order like that, in order to make hybrid systems and, you know, something that's adapted to their ear and their eye and the way they like to work, it's pretty cool to see those things emerge.
For sure. For sure. And I would, I switched from, you know, most editors use two computers side by side. So you have a lot of space left and right, but that's not really the space you need. You really need vertical space, not horizontal, because you're working on a timeline. And I might have, on the current show I'm working on, I've got over 20, 24 audio channels that I'm juggling with split track, you know, original dialogue, a bunch of sound effects, and then music. And then I might have 12 or 15 layers of video because I'm conforming animation from overseas, and I've got to be able to have previous versions that we can look at quickly. I've got to label everything anyway. So yeah, I need vertical space to edit. And so I got one big monitor and people would walk into my edit suite and be like, wow. It was just like, no, this is the appropriate thing. And no one had ever questioned why we didn't just do it this way.
Right.
You know? So not that I was the originator of that. I stole it from another editor, but yeah, the right tool for the right job.
The piecemealing of everything. Like when you find a good idea, you yank it over and like eventually you become a collection of all the things that you've seen and tried and have failed not. And that's why when you run into somebody that to me, like a real pro, like a super pro at something, you're buying all those choices that they've made for the last 15, 20 years.
That's right.
And that's why they can do stuff so fast. It's just incredible to watch how quickly, you know, they assemble.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, you do the same thing, you know, like I use the same keystrokes 1,000 times a day. And if I can eliminate one of five keystrokes, then that saves me 20% of my work all day long. So yeah, and moving, the pandemic has caused a whole other, you know, complication with that because I'm working remotely. I'm dialing into another computer remotely and that's another bunch of steps and it's a PC instead of a Mac. And that's a nightmare. But otherwise, working from home has been fine.
I like it. So talk about some of the creative stuff. Take us back to Aqua Teen and roll us through your sort of creative experience with this industry a little bit.
Sure, sure. I got my first job in Atlanta, as I said, working at that post house on avid media composer, the first generation of media composer. And I did that for 3-4 years. And I got a job at Turner Broadcasting because they had just invested in avid media composers and they had two. They didn't know how to keep them organized or keep them running. So my first job was to like organize them so multiple editors could work on them and not step on each other's toes or delete each other's media, you know? So I did that. And then I had a choice to like go into management or go into editing. And I just preferred editing so much. So I went into editing full time while keeping the things organized. You know, hurting editors is definitely hurting cats.
Everybody in production, and it's all hurting.
Yes.
Some different type of cat.
Yes. So, of course, I gravitated towards more long format, more storytelling kind of editing. But at Turner in the 90s, it was just, you know, Turner's programming was sports and reruns. So the only original programming was either like sports packages or commercials for the reruns or you know, network packaging, that kind of thing. So I did that off and on for a couple of years, but the only long format storytelling was really at Cartoon Network. And the only show was Space Ghost Coast to Coast. So that's the first kind of episodic thing I worked on.
That was a beloved show, right? I mean, that show,
it's a great show. Yeah. And it holds up because even back then it was about nothing. It was very Dadaist humor to begin with. And they'd get C-list celebrities. And the way the show was produced is they'd do the interview first with someone pretending to be Space Ghost, the animated superhero who now has a late night talk show. And then they would rewrite all the questions and re-edit the responses for comedic purposes. The other variable in this scenario is the voice artist who voiced Space Ghost is a guy named George Lowe. He's still around, he's still doing voices. He's a crazy person. And he came out of radio. So where, you know, that kind of bombastic voice that was announcing the radio call letters, which is the perfect voice for Space Ghost because he's also bombastic in that way. Right. But I wouldn't say George is the best actor, which is no great slight to George. He's a great voice guy. So the only line, but he would also go on these 30-minute rants in the middle of the voice session. So for a 12-minute cartoon, I might get 90 minutes of voiceover and 5 minutes of the script, and the rest right. is just George ranting. So part of my job was to catalog all the George rants because it would actually have more emotional content than the reads that they had written. So we would go into the edit suite and we'd cut the script, and you know, the script was written off of a transcript of the interview. So that wouldn't exactly match the tone of what right. the person was saying. So we would, you know, oftentimes, I don't want to give myself too much credit, but oftentimes we would rewrite whole sections of the show from all this stuff that I would catalog from George and all the random stuff I would catalog from the interview. So it was really almost like a documentary editing where you'd create conversations from all this chaos.
That sounds fun. That sounds like a fun editing job. That would be great.
It is pretty fun. It's a lot of late nights.
Yeah. I mean, there's, again, you're trying to pull together linguistically things that kind of match up, and like you remember something back here that fits this, and it's funny because it's a disjuncture and all that stuff. So there's a lot going on, but that sounds like intellectually kind of a fun creative project.
It was really a fun show to work on. And that's why the show had the weird timing and weird, you know, pacing that it had, because we'd come up with a good section that worked, but then we'd have to kind of stop and start over. Like you'd run yourself into a dead end, but then that you just put in a pregnant pause of the characters staring at each other, and then you'd start over with a new conversation.
Yeah. And a lot of those workarounds creatively, like when you have to back match with what you've actually got, become the most interesting things because they're odd workarounds. And, you know, just something that nobody would have thought of exactly unless you had to fix this particular problem.
That's right. That's right. Editing is problem solving. So this was definitely the cornerstone of that. The other thing about Space Ghost Coast to Coast is that it could only have been made by these people in this place at this time. Like maybe that's true of every show. And maybe I'm not really saying anything, but it's such a weird show. Mm-hmm. You could not have made it 10 years earlier because the technology didn't exist. You could not have made it at any other network because every other network would have said no to it because it's so weird.
Right.
And so, yeah, only these people, only this time, you know, only these people with this kind of taste would, where you'd get to interview the Ramones, but you'd also interview Susan Powder, who was a late night infomercial personality at the time, you know? So yeah, it's particular to its era.
Well, and again, I think when you, a lot of times when you just lay out elements, you know, and you're like, okay, here's the elements we've got to work with. Now make that, you know, entertaining, make that fit within the structure of the show. Then, like you said, that's the creativity goes up and you're like, oh, we could try this. And like, well, we got to do something, you know, throw this in there and see if it works. And then you get that kind of, again, unpredicted creativity, I think.
That's right. That's right. And it was kind of, and it was the starter point for Adult Swim, of course. But part of that was that it was done so cheaply. There was some new animation, but it was, when I say the technology didn't exist, like there was no new animation for each new episode. We would just re-edit existing animation to match the new thing we had edited, we'd created, you know?
Yeah. So how many times can you rebake the same cookie?
Well, yeah, if you just have different, you know, one new ingredient every time, it's a little different every time.
Sure. No, again, I love that stuff. One of the things I like about stand-up is that it's so repetitive. Like the script is the script is the script. But if you're a writer, every time you go up, you add elements to the script. So it's always got its, you know, core, but it's just fun to go up and like, well, I wonder what's going to emerge this time.
Absolutely.
You know, I've done a bit, there are bits I've done for 20 years and I won't do it for a while. And I'll come back and do it again somewhere. And suddenly it's got another 8 minutes. You're like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Where'd that come from? The voice of Master Shake on Aqua Teen is one of my good friends. And I've been around him and he's such a good storyteller that I'll hear him tell the same story like 5 days in a row. And I'm laughing harder on day five than I've ever laughed at the same thing. I know what's coming, you know, because he's a comedian who refines and refines and refines. Just like you say.
Yeah. Okay. So Space Ghost, cool. Keep us rolling. Where'd you wander next?
So after I had cut about, I thought I was getting in late on Space Ghost. And I was edited episode 17. The guest was Carrot Top. Workout Carrot Top.
Pre-roid
Carrot Top. So then when a couple of the writers, Dave Willis and Matt Malero, were starting a new show to premiere on Adult Swim, before Adult Swim even had a name, they convinced me to leave my good job at Turner Broadcasting as an employee and go freelance and work on their pilot. So I did that in 2000, and that became Aqua Teen Hunger Force, which started slow. Like we did the pilot and I tell this story, but Dave and Matt may deny it. They started production on episode 2 before getting a green light. And so the executives were like, all right, fine, make 6, but you also have to make 6 Space Ghosts, which no one wanted to do because they were all burnt out on that after 5 years of doing that.
Right.
So we did 6 Aqua Teens and 6 Space Ghosts. And the next year we got to do 12 Aqua Teens, and then it took off and we were doing 30 a year for a while. So I left my good job to go work on this talking meatball show that no one thought was a good idea. I ended up working on that show for 14 years.
Wow. Yeah. That's a run.
From 2000 to 2014.
That's solid. Like that's an unusual story in the world.
It's very rare that you work at one place, let alone one series for a decade, unless it's The Simpsons.
Yeah, I think it's funny that The Simpsons are now getting legacy hires, like kids of old writers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's on, I mean, it's been going for, I mean, yeah, the first Simpsons short that I saw, I was in college. And it's still going. So that was weird. And I saw Adult Swim go from, you know, 2 hours on Sunday nights to 5 nights a week to most of Cartoon Network's, you know, profits. I left in I was there forever. Like I also saw it through the TV on DVD boom, which was, you know, 2005 to 2008. Mm-hmm. So there were years when Aqua Teen DVD sales were a shockingly significant portion of the pie of Cartoon Network's profits. You know, they threw us a party after we sold our 1 millionth DVD.
Wow.
Which is incredible. Like, yeah. It's crazy. So part of my job was also, in addition to editing episodes, I produced the extra content for the DVDs. And so that was like, so I'd get the budget and I'd spend about half on production. I'd be able to keep the other half because I was writing and producing and editing and shooting them, shooting everything. We got into like shooting short films. We had enough budget to like just shoot a short film with the actors from Aqua Teen that had nothing to do with the show itself. Those are called Terrorphone. If you're going to look those up on YouTube, they're very funny, I think.
Yeah, I'll bet.
But it was the kind of thing where Dana was coming to town. Dave and Matt wrote a script on Monday, and we were shooting in a house with props and a crew on Thursday.
Yeah.
And I was the producer, and so I would line produce, put to find a crew, because I was an indie filmmaker, so I could use my contacts to get a film crew together, you know, video crew together. But we were doing special effects and all kinds of stuff for literally 3 days of pre-production, 2 days of pre-production. Shoot it in one day, and then I'd also edit. I'd also be AD on set, and I'd cut it together. So I'm real proud of those. It's Terrorphone 1, 2, and 3. They're on the DVDs.
Yeah, that's definitely something to check out. I have a buddy. I don't know if you know Chris McGuire. His last show was running Martha Stewart and Snoop Dogg, and Snoop Dogg has a new show out. I don't know exactly what it is, but Chris posted something yesterday about. Because I shot 26 pages of sketches over the weekend, and here's what happens when the writers no longer want to come in and be characters, and it was him in a rabbit suit.
Yeah. I have to be a character. I have to be like, anyway, watch the Terrorphone. They break a third wall. They break the fourth wall, whichever wall it is.
Yeah, they used to drag me into sketches. I'm a terrible actor, like awful. I just can't. It's just... I've never done much of it, and I'm not that interested. I'm not interested in it at all. But I used to run the other writer's sketches regularly on talk shows. They'd be like, "Oh, you gotta do a set." I'm like, "Yeah, you don't really want me in there."
Yeah, I'm bad too. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, cool. So that show's had. I mean, that show's gonna have a life, don't you think? Forever, like it's always gonna have its cultness, and
it certainly will. That HBO Max has gotten involved because they're doing new Aqua Teen shorts. I did a little work on those this year. And they're doing a second Aqua Teen movie, which is in production now.
Nice.
So yes, it will go on forever.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I see now, like that sort of recovering old stories and old characters, and, you know, it's not even just, it's just the aesthetic's different, you know, the speed of the cut, everything is different. And so it's taking that old story and, you know, moving it up into this new production models and the way you watch this up on the small screen and everything. So yeah, that stuff seems like it's always going to be nicely recyclable in a positive way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always weird watching those shows that started in the early 2000s and then lasted into 2010s because they go from standard def to HD. It's like watching Gilligan's Island go from black and white to color.
Yeah. When do they resurrect Gilligan's Island? No.
I'm surprised it hasn't come back. Right? Every other sitcom has. There's never been a Gilligan's Island like movie, right? Like a reboot movie.
God, was there a TV movie?
There was definitely a 90s TV movie, like Return to Gilligan's Island. Yeah. That was the original cast. I'm talking about like the Dukes of Hazzard or Charlie's Angels reboot style reboot.
Yeah, I don't think there's been a Gilligan reboot. Well, they'd have to do to like The Rock. Maybe The Rock is on the island now.
Well, he's doing Jungle Cruise, so he's halfway there.
Right? It's like everything that's in a Disney park is now going to become a movie. It's like the popcorn. What?
Absolutely.
I'm friends with Terry Rossio a little bit, and I know his wife pretty well. And I've watched them do the Pirates of the Caribbean over and over again. And I'm like, man, why don't you just make a money press? Why don't you just print a, because at this point, yeah. It's like, just keep making the movie.
I was on a panel with Terry at the Austin Film Festival.
That's right. You know those guys, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, just from hanging out at the Austin Film Festival. And I was like on a panel with like Terry and a bunch of other like heavy hitter screenwriters, and I did not belong. I was like the indie, I was like the Adult Swim indie film guy. And then people would ask, how many of your scripts have actually been produced? And they'd be like, one out of 50. You know, and I was like, everything I've ever written, I've produced. You know, and then I was talking about, I made a feature while I was with my DVD proceeds. I made a feature film in 2006. That's why I go to the Austin Film Festival. It premiered there. But I was talking about my feature, and I was like, it's a beach party movie. Like, it's literally like I tried to make an actual 60s beach party movie. So if you get the reference, you like it. You might even love it. But if you don't get the reference, it makes no sense.
Right.
So I was like, at least I didn't make, and I referenced some movie that I hated. And Terry Rossi was like, I wrote that.
Yeah, it's so funny. Like, every once in a while you get thrown on panels down there. I was like that once where they had one of the original creators of Two and a Half Men. They had Paul Feig, you know, who had just made Bridesmaids. And then some other guy who was like a long-term sitcom guy that everybody, you know, he'd made every sitcom, and then it was me. And I'm like, yeah, I'm filler. I'm that's what I just call me, is filler number four.
Filler, not Jerry Stiller. Jerry, no, Filler.
Jerry, that's Filler.
Jerry Filler.
That'd have been a good, reference. Where were you when I needed a good joke? All right. So Aqua Teen. And then I knew you, that's when I met you. I think you were still in Atlanta. And I remember talking to you a little bit about when you were getting ready to trying to make that decision about moving to LA from, you know, Atlanta. And then I think we rehooked back up once you were starting to work at you'd start working at Disney.
That's right. That's right. I had a friend call me. I was thinking about moving. I was in Atlanta. I'd been in Atlanta for 20 years. And thinking about trying LA, and then a friend of mine from Cartoon Network who had moved over to Disney was like, do you know any editors in LA? We can't find a creative editor for this show. And I was like, maybe I'll come out and do it. So I did. And it was Gravity Falls, huge hit for them. I worked on part of season one with the creator, who was like 23 at the time.
Nice.
Very, very creative guy, but a very, you know, inexperience causes for some stops and starts during production. Alex Hirsch is a genius. I'm not going to talk shit about Alex Hirsch, but yeah, there was some stops and starts through production. And he was like of a mind that was like, why do we have to do all this stupid union stuff? Can't I just edit the show myself? I'm like, well, not if Disney's paying the tab. Sorry.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a good experience. Like, you know, like when I moved to LA, and worked for Disney as an animation editor for about 5 years. It was literally the fourth job of my adult life, which is super weird. Like I had
right. Yeah, that's nothing.
And then I was at Turner, and then I was at Adult Swim for 14 years. So literally the fourth job of my adult life at age 42.
So what do you think about Disney? Like, I mean, I know I have some writer friends that write movies for them, and I think they've had a positive experience. It is its own kind of monolith. And like you said, it's so big, they've got to have different business practices and creative and production practices. But, you know, I think they kind of like it, the fact that it's so super organized, as opposed to like the constant freelance royal and kind of just sort of figuring things out on the, you know, as you go.
Sure. Sure. And I went freelance and worked. I was like a full-time freelancer at Adult Swim. So, you know, there was one summer where I just took 3 months off. I was like, I need a break. I've been doing this for 12 straight years full-time. I need to take a break. So I took a break and wrote for a summer, which was great. You know, and then they like had an emergency job they needed me to do. And I did that for a month in the middle. So it wasn't really a break. Right. I made a bunch of money, you know, because anyway, so yeah, I then moved to Disney, where it was a huge pay cut, to be an animation editor, which got paid the same as like an assistant editor at the time. And that was just union. That wasn't necessarily Disney, but it's just like, that's the system.
Right.
And I learned that I much prefer the rolling chaos of being a freelancer. I like having a 3 month break every 6 months. Mm-hmm. You know, I can go write and do my own things. I'm trying to make short films. I'm trying to write scripts, you know, doing other things, starting a baseball blog, you know, doing other things. I was at Disney for 5 years. I worked on 2 seasons of Craig McCracken's show, Wander Over Yonder, which is great. Great experience there. I love Craig. But that just tells you how different animation is from the rest of entertainment.
Right.
One season two of Wander Over Yonder. I'll break it down for you.
Okay, do
fill
it.
Some time. I'm going to fill some time here.
All right, do it.
This won't be boring, I don't think. So it's 22 half hours, but there's 2 episodes per half hour. So that's 44 quarter 15 minute shows, really 44 10 minute episodes. And if you think about it, like even if you're producing an episode a week, it's 44 weeks to do one part of the process. So that's 44 stories to break, 44 scripts to write, 44 sets of backgrounds to draw, 44 sets, like 44 new characters, because there's like a guest character in each episode. So I cut the animatics, which is cutting the storyboards together on that. So even if you were turning around a storyboard a week, it's forever. Like we would usually have a week or a week and a half to cut a storyboard and then it had to ship. Editing an animated series is like being at a train station and the train comes every week and you better get on that train because it's moving.
Right.
You know, you got to produce these episodes because you fall behind schedule and it just compounds and compounds and compounds. So that's what editing, you know, so editing on that show, I did storyboards for a year and then I moved on to post and started cutting the animation after I got back from the animation studio. And we do little tweaks and find mistakes and have to call retakes. So, you know, even if you're doing that once a week, you know, so it was 2.5 years of editing on one season of television.
Wow.
Of animated children's television.
And that, how did they set that up then? Like how much leeway or how much space was there between seasons? And
it just rolls and rolls and rolls. You know, you get the green light on season 2 as you're finishing season 1 and you immediately have to start writing, you know, coming up with ideas. If you haven't ever seen the show, viewers, listeners, Wander Over Yonder, it's a great kid show. It's very Looney Tunes. Voice of Jack McBrayer from 30 Rock is the lead character. He's great. The music is great. It's like weirdly bluegrassy Dixieland in outer space. So lots of space banjo. I did that for a long time, but then I wanted to get back into doing live action. I want to try my hand at that. So after Disney, I went freelance because I had some things set up. I did some Adult Swim shows, live action shows, one called Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell, which is a sitcom, a workplace sitcom set in hell.
Okay, I like it.
So like Satan is just like a really bad middle manager. So that show is really fun. Lots of improv, lots of green screen. So that's another show where you say, where's all the stuff that people never see?
Right.
Like, it's a show that would let the actors improv for like 10 minutes extra after the scene. The show is 10 minutes long. The entire episode is 12 minutes long. And here I have 10 minutes of improv. So it's one of those shows. It like lets the actors really play, but then that means I see 95% of their work and no one else in the world ever will unless you're
right.
But that show's really fun. Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell. And then I cut a feature with friends that made a feature called SuperCon. So even on the feature, that was, you know, 4 or 5 months, 6 months worth of work. And then you're back to being unemployed again. I love that. I did a couple sitcoms. And the difference between Atlanta and LA is like all the TV shows are made here.
Yeah.
Like even if you're shooting in Atlanta, post still goes back to LA.
Yeah.
It's like an incredible amount of production. And now that everything's opening back up, there's like a shortage of assistant editors. Like there's just not enough people to go around for all the shows that are trying to get started up.
Interesting.
Whereas in Atlanta, there was like, if you were an animation editor, there was like 2 places to work, Adult Swim and the guys who made Archer.
Right.
you know, so here there's a bazillion.
Well, that's the thing I was saying earlier, like all the comics, the stand-ups moving here from LA down to here. And LA is not a good town for stand-ups. New York is more of a stand-up town. Most people doing stand-up in LA are trying to do acting and things like that, which can make a nice career if you can get exposure on TV. And then, you know, your rates go way up when you start traveling doing stand-up. But the difference in moving and living in LA and just the amount of people who are doing the same work that you're doing, you know, and the fact that it's been being done there for 75 years and there's this massive infrastructure.
Right.
It's just not even close. It's nothing like it.
I describe it as a very high pressure karaoke world out here. Huh. If you're going into a karaoke bar, you're competing with some professionals.
Yeah. Right. I mean,
not that it's a competition, but yeah.
No, but I did some production when I first moved here. I had a little production company and did some short series for Super Deluxe. I think that was Turner.
And, yeah, that was Turner.
And then some local company that wanted to start its own little network. And trying to do production out of here, after learning production, I started at Fox and then I moved to NBC and CBS. And so I was always at the, like, oh, this is how editors work, right? This is how it all works. And then you come out here into the freelance world and you try to produce, you know, in a town that's kind of sleepy about its production. And you're like, oh my God, you're killing me. Like the director on the first thing I shot took a 2-hour lunch and just didn't tell anybody. Like, you know, everybody was sitting around waiting and I couldn't get him on the phone. I'm like, what?
What is
and you
happening?
Can't fire him because there's nobody.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I was in Atlanta with the shooting boom was cranking up. So when I was making indie films, there was always one and a half professional crews in Atlanta. You know what I mean? Like a big movie comes to town, they hire the good crew and that's about it, you know? But after Hollywood was shooting there for 10 years, there's dozens and dozens of crews that size, enough people to crew up 12 movies.
Right.
So when I was trying to shoot some short stuff in, what was that, 2010, I couldn't find a crew anywhere. Like I couldn't find anybody. I couldn't find a grip to save my life or an art department, you know? They were all booked a year out. It's different. It's probably a little better now. But yeah, like there's so much production there. It's ridiculous.
Well, and again, nobody really sees it unless you're actually in the industry. It all looks like a big castle on the hill unless you're in there and you see all the flurry and you see where it's done well and where it's not done well. And you're like, oh my God, this is like every other industry. You know, it's either like the 10%, 20% that are really resonating and you're like, oh, that's why they're making great stuff. And then everybody over here like, oh, that's why they can never make anything that's any good. And I've seen a lot with writing staffs, you know, people sort of throwing together staffs and not knowing how to work with comedians, you know, which is a specialized population that you need to learn how to work them so that they will give you what you want.
I don't want to offend you as a comedian, but to call comedians a specialized population is one of the funniest lines you have ever written.
You know, I'm trying to be nice here on the podcast. I don't, you know, one of the they're their own thing, like getting them to be productive. And the nature of comedy is to not be productive.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Or to be the center of attention if you're a room with three people.
Well, and you've got the guys like that. You need some energy in the room. Like you need verbal people, but they're usually not very useful. They say a lot and they're entertaining, but not in a way that you can actually use in the show. But they get enough energy in the room that the little, you know, nerd wonk writers who never say anything, you just sit there and feed off of it and they end up writing the show.
Right. Sure.
So who's gonna tell the exec producer that, oh yeah, we've got these people that look completely useless and nothing ever gets on the show, but if you don't have their energy, it's going to kill the show.
Right. And if you don't have the nerds, you don't ever get a script written.
Yeah. And the nerds don't say anything. I got a buddy. I've never heard him say a funny word, but every show we've ever written on together, he's written the four best jokes.
Right.
Every time.
Yeah. Everybody has their process. Maybe it's in the room. Maybe it's, you know, by themselves with a computer.
Yeah. I used to have a friend named Bob Oshak. He writes on Mar now. I used to call him the Unijoker because he would take his hoodie and his earphones and he would just hovel into his computer station. You wouldn't see him for 3 or 4 hours. I'm like, how much work do these jokes need, dude? Because I'm a fast writer. But he would just unijoke. He would just completely disappear into his computer for 4 hours. So, yeah, everybody's got their stuff.
Sure. Sure. So there's working with comedians, and then there's being social around comedians. Two different things.
Well, I used to tell people all the time, like, they would be, hey, man, bring some comedians to this party. I'm like, no, you don't. You don't put two comedians in with a bunch of citizens, like ordinary humans. That's going to be bad. Because you know how, like, here's the range of what you think is funny. Well, comedians together aren't going to start up here, and it's not going to get much worse.
And then they're going to top each other.
Yeah, it's just, you don't want that.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, the ordinary can't take that kind of joking. But, well, okay, so you're at Netflix now. Tell me what's on the horizon. And you're doing freelance stuff. You're trying to do more of your own stuff.
Yeah, I was freelancing for a while. I had some stuff come and go. Like again, the amount of production here is ridiculous. Like two of the sitcoms I did, I made for the production company was Verizon. Back when they had Verizon Go 90, which was their streaming service. But okay. You didn't need to be a Verizon customer to use it. It was free. There weren't even any ads on it. And they were producing a shitload of content for that. And then the second sitcom I was on, the both of them were really interesting. Like, they were trying to do interesting stuff. The first one was an office sitcom in the world of secret agents, but CIA, like policy wonks, and how the CIA, like all the different intelligence departments compete against each other, and how office politics always trumps actually stopping terrorists.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's called Liberty Crossing. It's on Amazon, I think, now. But anyway, it's a really fun little sitcom. So I worked on that. And then I worked on a talking dog show that will never come out because it's so weird. But that was for Verizon. And then in the middle of post on that, Verizon pulled the plug on their Go 90 platform because it didn't make any sense.
Like, I've never even heard of it.
I knew tons of people that were working on those shows because they were like kind of medium to low budget, but would give you lots of creative potential. So yeah, I know there was a ton of work out here for something that no one ever heard of, which is, you know, pretty common in LA.
Yeah, that's right.
So then it went back to the production studio and they finished it. And then they're still trying to sell it. Anyway, so I did that. And then freelance I wanted to like buy a house and live like an adult.
What?
In Los Angeles. I know. Foolish thinking. So that's when I took this Netflix job. And 3 years later, I have a house in East LA, the cheapest house in LA you can buy, but the most expensive house in every other market in the United States. And I love it. Thank God I had it during the pandemic because now I'm a gardener. Never thought that would happen. I hate yard work. But yeah, house projects will definitely keep you home and keep you busy when you can't leave. So
you're the only guy I've known that's ever invited me to a fig barbecue. So I think you've
got some
kind of horticulture in you.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. That was the first rental house I had in LA. I had a fig tree in the front yard. So I'd pick the figs and grill them and make fig bourbon, like soak a bottle of bourbon with figs. Huh. That's dangerous stuff.
I have two fig stories. One's that. The other one is I live in Glendale, which is heavily Armenian and Middle Eastern. And the guy across the street I got to be buddies with him because our kids played together. And every once in a while, he'd knock on my door and like just shove a plate of something in my face and be like, Dan, figs from my village. They sent figs. Of course you're offering me figs at my front door. Of course you are.
Yeah. Glendale's super weird. Fun.
It is. I liked Glendale. I would have my kids out in the front yard and the little old Armenian ladies who did not speak anything even remotely close to English would harangue me about having my very white kids out in the sun. I couldn't understand what they were saying, but I knew what they were saying.
Sure. Sunscreen.
Yeah. How dare, you know, it's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, I got you.
So took a full-time job at Netflix, which has been great. They're very nice. They're very like, it's not run. It's almost, it's comparable to Adult Swim in that they really just want creators to do their job. You know, they don't want to put them in a box or constrain them. They're like, yeah, we need that kind of show. Go make it. We're not going to harass you. The budgets are very different, of course. Adult Swim's budgets are so small.
Well, all that stuff showed up after I left LA to raise the kids here in Austin. So I wasn't there in the Netflix and the Amazon and all that kind of stuff. So I haven't seen that production, but Netflix, I don't get it. Like, maybe it's because, you know, I was there during studio and network and all that, but like, what is Netflix? Like, where do they get all this money?
It's not a production company. It's a technology company. So, and again, I'm not part of like Netflix mothership, Netflix Central. I've only been part of Netflix Animation, which they started from the ground up.
Yeah.
You know, four years ago. When I went through, I don't think I'm throwing anything out, because when I got hired and went through orientation 2.5 years ago, they had over 100 animation properties in development or production, 110.
Wow.
And that's series, movies, specials, you know, limited series, whatever. Like, if you compare that to like Disney or Nickelodeon, who will have 6.
Right. Yeah. As soon as you said that, I'm like, that's what I mean. Like, I don't understand that production, that business model. It's crazy.
Right. Right. And it's not like there's no commercial breaks. They can be any length. So we'll have episodes on the show I'm working on now, which is called Kid Cosmic. We have episodes that are 24 minutes. And we have episodes that are 18 minutes. It's just whatever the story dictates. And as long as you have the right amount of animation that your budget calls for at the end right. of the thing, you know, it doesn't matter. The story can dictate it. And they're very supportive. The technology, they really want just like technology to work for you, because they're a technology company. So yeah, there's some growing pains with any company, but it's been great. And again, yesterday, the trailer for season 2 of Kid Cosmic dropped. I don't know where it dropped from. That phrase always bugs me. It premiered, it came out. So anyway, there's a trailer for season 2 of Kid Cosmic. It came out yesterday. Season 2 and 3 were announced. We've been in production on season 2 and 3 for 2 years.
Wow.
Secret. But they announced that season 3 has been greenlit. I don't know why they have to do that. Anyway, so yeah, like when I got hired to do this animated series, I knew it would be 3 years of work. And so I bought a house because I knew I would have a job.
Yeah. No, so that's solid. Yeah. Uncancelable.
Yeah. I mean, there are downsides to that. It's like, it's not, you don't greenlit 3 seasons. It's really just 1 season
right.
without a break. You know, normally you don't get greenlit until you're done and then there's a break and then you go back into it. But we've gone sprinted straight through, 3 seasons worth.
Yeah. I mean, I like it seems to me it does have a good vibe, corporate vibe and that kind of stuff. I worked at Fox, which was the worst vibe ever, because they were importing their business model over into their, you know, running their creative shows. And I'm like, everybody here looks like they're about to be shot. Like, why is everybody, the accounting people and the book, they're so stressed. And they would walk through the accounting department had to walk through the comedian's row to get to their,
oh my God,
their offices. And I remember one day the head of accounting just walked through and she was, if I hear a goddamn word from a comedian right now.
The scale of things is so shocking. Like Adult Swim development was the head of Adult Swim, Mike Lazo, and an assistant. And I think he had another kind of assistant development person in LA. And that was the whole development department, was those 3 people. And then I was on a panel at the Austin Film Festival with the head of Fox development just for sitcoms. I was like, how big is your department? He's like 110 people.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, their budgets are also 1,000, like they're spending 1,000 times more money than Adult Swim is, but still, and Adult Swim's only filling a couple nights a week, a couple hours.
Still, they're not, that's disproportionate no matter however you're going to compare it.
It's incredible. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Now I don't know. I think when I see things like Netflix come up and force new business models into that old kind of entertainment structure, you know, industry, I think it's a good thing. I think, you know, you're going to get, like you said, growing pains creatively. A lot of the shows, you know, won't work, but the ones that do just work spectacularly. You know, it's just fun to watch.
Yeah, that's the idea. Is more darts to throw at a wall. Is the Adult Swim model. You know, there's a lot of shows that Adult Swim developed that you never heard of because they're bad. But, you know, it's not like Fox doesn't develop bad shows.
Yeah, well, it's, what is it, 70% failure rate of all shows, I think, that don't even, you know, make it to air. So, well, cool, man. I'm gonna let you go so that you can go meet your dog walker.
I'm gonna go meet my dog walker. That's how it's real life works.
That you're real LA. You serve figs. You have a dog walker. Look at that. She needs to be walked.
There's the dog. That makes for good podcasting, showing you a picture of my dog.
Does the dog walker have to carry that dog?
There's a wheelbarrow involved.
That's awesome. Well, cool, man. I'm glad to catch up. Like we, you know, every once in a while tick each other on social media or something. But the last time I talked to you, I think, was at the fig party.
So, that's a long time ago.
Yeah. And I think it's nice to see like you've grooved into LA.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. I love it. I tell you, the sales point of LA to me is everything is cheap except for rent and mortgages. Like tacos are cheap and delicious. But also the movie culture here, if you like movies, the movie culture here is incredible. It's not the making of it. It's the screening of it. Mm-hmm. Like before the shutdown, I had 3 or 4 theaters that I would go to on a regular basis to see something on 35mm film that you could not see anywhere else. The New Beverly would show a double feature for $8. And it was these bizarro kung fu movies or 60s comedies or 70s exploitation. It's incredible. And then there's several theaters that would just have repertory or weirdo programming. And it was incredible. Every week you could see something incredible. So yeah. I love that about it. Hopefully I'll be able to go back to a movie theater someday.
Yeah. And I think I tell people all the time who really haven't ever lived in LA and they're bad mouthing LA. I'm like, well, just bad mouth humanity then, because it's got everything. Literally everything is there. And if you can't find stuff you enjoy, then, you know, stay out in the whatever and go hunt because it's got everything.
Yeah. I'm really into garage rock. So if I went to a garage rock show in Atlanta, I'd see the same 30 people. Whereas LA has a garage rock scene, but there's 27 of them. You know, each neighborhood has a garage rock crowd, you know? Orange County has its own garage rock scene. So yeah, everything's just exponentially bigger. Whatever you're looking for.
Well, and especially for a guy like you.
I'm in Atlanta and Austin, you just might be in a crowd of 3 people.
Yeah.
You know, whereas here you're gonna find a bigger crowd.
Right, and I tell people, like I moved there as a stand-up and a comedy writer, and I knew probably, I don't know, 100, 150 Southern stand-ups in LA because they all end up moving there. I knew more people from the South in LA than I knew in the South.
Absolutely.
And so it's just a conglomeration culture, you know, and like when you find your things, like I know you've got an aesthetic for that kind of B movie and, you know, all that kind of world. And it's just so thick. You can never consume it all.
Exactly. You find a vein and you drill down into it and it opens up into a chasm and you never get out. I was speaking, before this, I was going to be late because I started drilling into Discogs, you know, where you log all your records.
Okay.
And then you shop for records, which is dangerous. I started shopping for records about baseball. And I was just like, I was never going to get out of that vein. So anyway, I'm gonna pitch one more thing before you go. I've written a feminist Godzilla Western feature script.
See, that's what I'm saying. This place, you know, the conglomeration is perfect for you.
That's right. That's right. It's essentially Godzilla in the Old West. But all the men in this version of the Old West died when the aliens showed up. So it's a world of mostly women and just crippled old men. So the women have to take on all these traditionally roles that were played by men in the old Westerns. So it's a feminist Western, but it's not a woman like getting revenge on the guy who killed her husband, which is the only feminist Western that has ever existed. So I've written that script. It's essentially like, it's very Good, the Bad, the Ugly. It's very spaghetti Western. So in order to like convince people I can make a Godzilla Western, which which I pitched it to a screenwriter friend of mine. He's like, yeah, you're gonna have to self-finance that one. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. So I've been making feminist spaghetti Western short films.
Oh, that's awesome.
Called the Western Trilogy. The Hat Box Trilogy. I've already forgotten because I made them before the pandemic. Anyway, go to my Vimeo.com/JWadeEdwards. And there's a short film called The Condemned, which is a Western that I shot with my friends on my phone, nice. Which doesn't sound bad, but it's actually pretty great. So there's a second one in production now, and there's a third one being written. So,
well, cool. Yeah, send me any links you want. I'll throw them into the YouTube show notes, and people can check that stuff out.
Great.
And again, totally worth it. Like I've always enjoyed your aesthetic and your eye for these different, you know, crazy little projects that you put together. So,
well, thanks.
Super cool. Yeah.
We could go on another whole dead end of iPhone technology, but we'll do that another time.
Yeah, I'll circle back around, and next time, you know, you can tell your dog walker to bring you along, and we'll go on the walk with the dog, and we'll talk about iPhone technology.
That's right. It's its own kind of rhetoric.
Yeah, for sure. Well, cool, man. I appreciate it. Super fun catching up. Everybody, this has been Jay Wade. Check out his stuff and come back again, and keep coming back to the Rhetoric Warriors. Get out there, persuade some people. They always need it.